Dr. Alan Palmer is a member of the communications faculty at Brigham Young University and director of international media studies. After graduating from BYU in journalism in 1969, Professor Palmer studied at the Annenberg School for Communication at the University of Southern California. He received his doctorate in communication theory and research from the University of Utah. Professor Palmer joined the BYU Communications Department in 1998 after teaching at Ricks College and the University of Mauritius in the Indian Ocean. In 2004, he was a Fulbright Scholar in Namibia. He was also a visiting professor at the University of Pristina in Kosovo and has completed teaching assignments for the U.S. State Department and other agencies in East Africa, South America, Southeast Asia, and the Middle East. He is an officer in the International Association of Media and Communications Research. Dr. Palmer's research has been published in numerous journals and books. At BYU, he teaches courses in comparative media, communication processes and effects, and international communication problems. Professor Palmer and his wife, Dr. Lori Palmer, who is an associate academic vice president at Utah Valley State College, are the parents of 6 children and the grandparents of 13. Dr. Palmer.
Thank you, President. We are witnessing events that never would have been visible to us before the reach and speed of today's new communication technology. Momentous events like the Indian Ocean tsunami last year that devastated parts of Indonesia, Sri Lanka, Thailand, and southern India. Events that once were a world away now are routinely replayed in our living rooms and on our video phones. These images evoke strong emotions in a global audience. I am particularly interested in how the media, especially the international media, affect us emotionally. We should ask some preliminary questions as we begin. Do people experience similar emotions across cultures? Perhaps, at some level, for certain emotions, but there are important emotional differences in cultural experience. How does the extension of communication technologies across cultures alter our experience of these emotions? I think these are interesting and important questions in international communication. Now, international communication is a relatively new academic field, dealing with how nations and cultures interact in today's media-saturated world. One of my first tasks here today is to explain to you what international means, because it is a matter of some debate. How far do you have to travel before you become sufficiently international? Is it enough to travel across one international boundary or speak more than just one language? We find the word global is now used as a synonym for international. I recently submitted a chapter for a textbook titled International Communication, only to find the editor had changed the book's name and all the references in the chapters to Global Communication. When looked at carefully, the terms global and international are not exactly synonymous. While international connotes a limited reach across just a few borders, global suggests a broader, holistic view of the entire Earth. But many advocates for globalization suggest we now only need to master one language to participate in globalization. And in the absence of other contenders, that language has become English. And somewhat ironically, global citizenship does not require any travel at all, just a TV, a cell phone, and the internet. The concept of globalization itself is very polarized and politicized. Perhaps globalization really is a new spin on the concepts of modernity and progress, which have become overused and somewhat abused. Among those who favor globalization are supporters of democracy and the free market. Among those who argue against globalization, the so-called global skeptics, are human rights and labor advocates who believe the world is definitely not flat. Global transparency is a kind of necessary illusion in today's society. We have a sense that our vision penetrates distant horizons, but it produces a very limited, one-dimensional kind of knowledge. In terms of global identity, some people think of themselves less as citizens of a particular nation, but prefer to be known as intercultural or as a citizen of the world. Only a few years ago, we worried about the rootlessness of anyone without a passport or a country. Today, because of increased mobility, there are people who choose not to identify their roots in a national culture or identity, considering them to be too narrow or limited. They are truly global citizens. Communication technologies have created a blurring of national identities. Perhaps this is clearest in the creation of cyber communities and even at least one cyber nation. This virtual nation was created on the internet, known curiously enough as the Dominion of Melchizedek. You can check it out at the webpage www.melchizedek.com. We have recognized for some time that the media technologies are particularly important in the creation of national identities. But the new global technologies raise some unprecedented questions about the role of technology in identity transformation. Anthony Giddens, one of the leading writers about global society, has described this new kind of interdependence that we share around the world, driven by technological change. It has made an important difference in most people's everyday lives. Quoting Giddens, "We can communicate with anyone at any point in the earth and at any time in an instantaneous way. Instantaneous communication changes many aspects of how we live." In a sense, then, we have passed a tipping point wherein our technologies allow us to communicate faster and more freely, and that changes everything. Communication technology changes the configuration of our assumptions about how the world works and our place in it. Because television has become a pervasive influence in most of the world, even in some of the most impoverished neighborhoods of Asia, Latin America, and Africa, places built of cardboard and tin, many people will buy a TV even before they buy a refrigerator. A byproduct of this pervasive spread of technology is the rise of the culture industries. While elements of internationalization have existed for several centuries, the production and distribution of cultural products has never been as widespread and profitable. In truth, there probably have been very few instances of truly global communication in which messages are uniformly disseminated instantly to the entire world. About two-thirds of the world's population does not even have access to communication facilities like telephones. However, it is indisputable that the scope and reach of communication has never been so broad and distant, even if it falls somewhat short of global. Those few examples in which events are nearly global, however, have never been so dramatic as such as the fall of the Berlin Wall, the events of 9/11, or last year's tsunami in the Indian Ocean. For those who live within the pervasive influence of media, most people live in what Indian writer Arjun Aparandai calls mediascapes. A mediascape is a new kind of worldview, the world as seen from inside our own personal information bubble. As we scan the media horizon, the world is presented to us in a blur of powerful images of people and events that leave us with strong but ill-defined feelings. By virtue of the popularity of media, there is common knowledge about distant places and events, but our knowledge creates an understanding that is extremely limited and relatively devoid of factual detail. We might say we have knowledge about the world, but we really don't know the world with any degree of intimacy. Today, we can only begin to speculate about the extent of this new knowledge base that is being shaped by communication technology. Research suggests, for instance, that many people believe the world is a more dangerous place because of the heavy diet of media technology in both entertainment and news. In terms of global knowledge, media audiences are often left with a paradox of having strong feelings about foreign issues that are based on a limited repertoire of factual information. Television, in particular, is a visual medium that relies on strong visual cues to hold an audience's attention. Television promotes a kind of visual logic that emphasizes simplicity, immediacy, and it hates ambiguity. This has strong implications both for traditional geographical literacy and geopolitical knowledge. It also implicates emotion. Ideally, the presumption of a global village is that new communication technologies will bring the world together, united in a spirit of seamless cooperation. While it is true there has emerged a general agenda in the global community, such as the rising concern for the environment and human rights, it's also clear that today's globalization is constructing new kinds of barriers between the human family. Evidence of these barriers is apparent in the recent protests over the political cartoons depicting the Muslim prophet Muhammad. Some analysts suggest that Western and Eastern cultures disagree on some very basic fundamental values, such as empathy, materialism, and fatalism. There are also deep misunderstandings over the nature of freedom and the sacred. In a sense, the offending cartoons, then, are not the problem directly. They are only symptoms of deeper barriers in cultural and emotional experience. In effect, we have been given a view of the deep, far corners of the world, and we cannot easily comprehend what we find there. Asian traditions rooted in Confucian philosophy are as different to us as are the oral traditions of Africa or the historical foundations of Middle Eastern cultures. For instance, because of some beliefs, certain cultures object to having their images captured or published in photographs. Some native cultures believe the photograph somehow captures their souls. Some in the Middle East object to taking or publishing photographs of women, as well as creating any visual images of the Prophet Muhammad. Other religious beliefs also present to us interesting global challenges. The media in Italy, as well as a number of other Roman Catholic countries, routinely report on divine manifestations of Mary, the Mother of Christ. When I was teaching in Africa 2 years ago, the government news agency in Namibia reported on a problem in a village where a spirit was appearing to set huts on fire, and a traditional healer was sought to banish the spirit. Some of these kinds of media reports challenge our own cultural assumptions, even as we challenge the cultural beliefs of others elsewhere when they see our lives and practices. But each stage of world history has brought its own challenges. The information age we have entered is clearly different from the industrial age of the 18th and 19th centuries. In terms of technology, we might say the printing press was for the industrial age what the television and the internet are to the information age. And just as in the industrial age, clearly there are winners and losers in globalization. To borrow a phrase, the global village is more than ever a turbulent place. Some of what the popular media offers also offends the spirit, which is what I would discuss further if this were a devotional instead of a forum. Most of my research and writing in the last few years deals with the question of global turbulence, or as the Doctrine and Covenants describes it, the perplexities of the nations. The study of emotions is one of the global perplexities. Historically, emotion has been part of the field of psychology. The first documented work on the study of emotions was done by Aristotle. Later, Charles Darwin wrote about emotional expression of humans and animals in the 19th century. More recently, emotions have been folded into the study of psychological aesthetics, social psychology, and even sociology. It is interesting that most advanced textbooks in neuroscience devote only minor space to emotions, and textbooks in some other fields that logically should be interested in emotion avoid it altogether. There are, however, a number of books published about the theory of emotion in such diverse fields as counseling psychology and film studies. Generally speaking, however, there is a persistent blind spot about how emotions are evoked by communication media. Stefan Mestrovic expressed the problem in this way, quoting, The role of emotions is mysteriously overlooked in the existing scholarly discourse concerning various aspects of the culture industry, end quote. Another writer acknowledged in a recent book that we simply don't yet know what impact global electronic media will have on how vast numbers of people experience emotion. Many people are rather uncomfortable foregrounding the study of emotions. As a result, there has never been a definitive theory of emotions that is accepted by experts from different academic fields. I have found it helpful to refer to one model of emotions developed by Robert Plutchik, formerly of the Albert Einstein College of Medicine. This model portrays emotions as colors on a spectrum, somewhat as an unfolding flower. Emotions at the center of this model are more intense, while those at the edges are derivative. There is some disagreement in many circles over what constitute the primary emotions, but in this model, they are moving clockwise from the top. First, ecstasy. Second, admiration. 3, terror. 4, amazement. 5, grief. 6, loathing. 7, rage. And 8, vigilance. If we examine those emotions at the center carefully, it appears that there are certain emotions that lend themselves better to mediation through the media. In other words, the contemporary media are more prone and effective in communicating particular emotions than others. Indeed, some contemporary writers have described the media as a kind of emotion machine, highlighting the somewhat artificial function of the media in invoking emotions. One line of research in communication studies has approached the question of what is called mood management, using the media to achieve desired emotional states. We may deliberately choose to view a TV program or movie to achieve a certain desired emotional state. One of my students described this role of the media when she told me that she and a group of her friends sometimes choose a sad movie to have a good cry because it makes them feel better the next day. Some advertising is strikingly successful in tapping into our emotions. Quoting again from writer Stefan Mestrovic, marketing of feelings has now gone so far that advertisements these days sell feelings that have no relationship to the product at all. End quote. I'd like to illustrate the point that emotions have become a focal point of our social and political lives through the media with two recent cases. The first case involves the promotion of fear to support a government science project. In the early 1990s, an advocacy group of scientists began a publicity campaign to build support for public funding of several science projects. One of those projects involved space engineering. The campaign produced a series of press releases discussing the statistical likelihood that a large meteorite or asteroid would hit the Earth in the distant future, and scientists should begin planning for ways to counteract such an event, and it would cost money. After introduction of the problem to public attention, there was some negative reaction by critics who argued that there are just too many important pressing problems for the public to become overly concerned about such events that may occur on distant horizons. By that time, however, several books and movies were in production that featured such cataclysmic events. The scientist project had been successfully introduced to the public agenda. Fear of asteroids striking the Earth became an imaginable and rational public worry. In a sense, the proposition of an asteroid striking the Earth became a possibility, then a probability. A second case was highlighted by the New York Times recently in a column written by a physician who described consulting with a patient who was HIV positive and was being treated for advanced AIDS symptoms. During a visit to consult with the doctor, the patient expressed fear about contracting bird flu, which has received considerable attention in the news media. The patient wanted to know from the doctor what she could do to prevent contracting the bird flu. As this physician described the paradox, the patient, who was faced with the devastating consequences and quite possibly impending death from AIDS, was afraid of the effects of catching the bird flu. This speaks directly to the power of the mass media to reorder our emotional agendas. Because of the communication media, we are acutely aware, as never before, of the potential pandemic threat of diseases such as the avian flu, hantavirus, and Ebola. The emotional response to such public threats is significantly different today than, say, the flu epidemic of 1918, and perhaps even the worldwide AIDS pandemic of our own generation. While it is rather clear that the media are effective in conveying fear, the recent history of terrorism suggests that acts of media violence are, in fact, perpetrated as a special kind of emotional communication. Fear is one of the dimensions of the new global condition. It is one of the primary global realities, largely, I believe, because of mass communication and the peculiar appeal of the visual shorthand of sound and pictures in television. It is widely recognized that the public panic from the radio broadcast of the War of the Worlds in 1938 was partly an outgrowth of the latent fear of Hitler's European expansion. A media atmosphere of fear sets up the conditions for which people react to different potential threats. We live in a mediascape of fear. In some instances, there is a cascading effect of emotions from media reports. The accumulating impact of some of these reports creates an amplification of danger and fear. One example is the incidence of severe acute respiratory syndrome, or SARS, in Asia in 2003. The anticipation of the spread of this disease created severe economic disruption in much of Asia for almost a year. The social construction of fear in media has other implications. David Althide recently pointed out in a book, the great fear is not of disease or of death, but of boredom, a sense of time on our hands, a sense of nothing to do, a sense that we are not amused, end quote. Now, this is an interesting commentary because it links two powerful emotions, fear and boredom, but it isn't fear as we ordinarily understand the term. But this helps explain how the media use fear to attract an audience and hold its attention. They also use a problem frame by telling us that there is an issue out there that could potentially affect us, and we should monitor it. In a broad sense, the pervasiveness of fear in a media-saturated society changes our social contract. Fear destroys justice because an oppressive society is one consumed by different levels of fear, such as fear of rebellion, fear of power, and fear of insurgents. The media, in fact, unwittingly play into this atmosphere of oppressive fear, a primordial attention-getting state of emotion. Let me comment here about mediation of some of the other emotions just briefly. For example, grief and sadness. There have been some dramatic shifts in media discourse of emotions associated with grief. Thanks to the media, for the first time, we are able to monitor humanitarian crises in far-flung locations around the world. Because of mass communication, we are acutely aware, as never before, about famines and disasters that once were simply beyond our reach. At the same time, we now recognize the difficulties posed by our ability to monitor the world's problems in real time. On one hand, thanks to the remarkable reach and speed of the media, we are somewhat more omniscient, truly a godlike quality. But we are aware of the extent of suffering in the world. When we are made aware of these problems, there is a moral imperative to help those who suffer. Simultaneously, however, we recognize our inability to respond to every problem in every corner of the world. This dilemma is a kind of compassion fatigue. This captures the paradox we face, knowing what should be done to respond to the world's problems and the limits of our human capacity to respond. Other interesting mediated emotions are rage. Perhaps the most well-known case of mediated rage was the role of a radio station in Rwanda in Central Africa in promoting the massacre of almost a million Tutsis in 1991 by spreading hatred and contempt. Another mediated emotion is amazement and surprise. The media provide for us something of the guilty pleasure of novelty and surprise. This is the strategy of tabloid television. Who among us would deny being drawn to a headline about the strange and bizarre news in these kinds of programs? However, there is a tendency for even mainstream media programmers to search out for the obscure, strange experiences, these events, and even medical conditions that appeal to our interests in the surprising. We have never been exposed to so many rare medical cases and conditions on a routine basis on network TV. I would like to take you to three interesting places where I have found clues to some of the mysteries and complexities in the margins of this new kind of global communication. For those familiar with Jared Diamond's best-selling book, you might think of this as a guns, germs, and steel approach to international communication. First, we'll go to the Philippine island of Mindanao, then to Kosovo in the Balkans of Central Europe. Finally, we'll visit Namibia in Southeast Africa. Each of these places provides some clues of the emergence of the mediation of global emotion I'm examining here. On a trip to the southern Philippines in 1998, I became interested in the history of the Tazaday people, who were first discovered living in caves in a remote forest in central Mindanao two decades earlier. This discovery has become a well-known case study in cultural anthropology and, I believe, a case study in nostalgia and global communication. News of the discovery of this primitive people, the Tazaday, was spread around the world rapidly. It appeared in all of the world's major news media. The Tazaday appeared twice on the cover of National Geographic magazine. Experts who visited the tribe suggested that they had no contact with the outside world for at least 600 years and lived in a state of simplicity and innocence, a virtual Garden of Eden. The history of this small group of Stone Age people had a significant impact on the rest of the world. Truly, this was a people living in a pure environment, unpolluted by the strife of war and contention. Language experts even said the Tazaday had no words in the vocabulary for war and fighting. Conflict was minimal. When President Ferdinand Marcos declared martial law in the Philippines in 1972, the outside world lost contact with the Tazaday for about 14 years. When martial law was lifted in 1986, a Swiss anthropologist hiked to the Tazaday village to see what had happened to this Stone Age tribe. They found the Tazaday wearing T-shirts from rock concerts and otherwise looking very modern. Accusations arose immediately that the tribe was a hoax, staged for the world media by the Philippine government minister of culture. Subsequent investigations by government and academic officials have been unable to sort out the legitimate from the fraudulent claims about the Tazaday's primitive lifestyle. One of the interesting footnotes in this case was who first publicly declared the Tazaday to be a Stone Age tribe. It was Charles Lindbergh, the famous aviator who first flew nonstop over the Atlantic Ocean. Lindbergh was among the celebrities who befriended the Philippine culture minister and was among the first visitors to the remote Tazaday village. The larger question, however, is why such a news story was so interesting to a global audience. The answer, I suggest, is that the message of this primitive tribe in the forest of the Philippines was overdetermined by the interests of global media. It seemed to travel an alternative path into global consciousness. Yes, there may have been some exaggerated claims about the Tazaday, but the phenomenon of global communication created an audience seeking the discovery of a primitive people who was unfettered by the problems of modern life. In a direct sense, there are striking parallels between the simple, innocent Tazaday of Mindanao and other anthropological case studies. The media portrayal of such cases has presented a simplified portrayal of indigenous people in a way that reinforces the global audience's preconceptions of what primitive people should look like instead of the reality of the people themselves. The media tap into the audience's need to reinforce their own beliefs. In the case of the Tazaday, the global media reinforced global myths of the virtue of a simple life, of people unaffected by contemporary problems. Thanks to the reach and penetration of the global media, we can now peer into some of the most turbulent regions of the world, places where old animosities and enmities pit one people against others. Places like Darfur, Rwanda, and Kosovo. These are places where the words genocide or war are loosely used to describe events. Some of these locations have been declared simply to be incomprehensible by the Western mass media because the problems are so foreign to Western values and understandings. We can only with difficulty understand the roots of these conflicts and their problems. The Balkans and Central Europe are one such place that has become a metaphor of loathing, with long-standing hostilities between ethnic and cultural groups. I visited the Balkans and the former nation of Yugoslavia on several occasions. The first time was in 1991, just a week before war spread across Serbia, Bosnia, Croatia, and eventually Kosovo. More recently, I had an assignment to teach at the University of Pristina in Kosovo in 2001. Visiting this land just a year after the Kosovo War was somewhat disorienting because of the wrenching problems that tore the land and people apart. One visitor to this region called this place a disinformation trap because of the difficulty of grasping the scope and reach of its problems. One of the flashpoints that compounds the problems in Kosovo has to do with language and how it is used to divide people. Lines are drawn between people and cultures, for instance, the Albanians and the Serbs, and the conflicts focus on their respective claims to the land. For the Serbs, Kosovo is sacred ground because of the history of conflicts between the Christians in the north and the Muslims of the Ottoman Empire in the south. One of the pivotal battles between these people took place in the region we now call Kosovo. Many of the ethnic Albanians who live in the region have been taught that their claim to the land dates from the ancient Illyrians, a pre-Christian era who settled the region. The nationalistic claims of Serbs and Albanians to the land arise from such deeply held historical claims of entitlement and ownership. On the other hand, the Serbs regard the land of Kosovo as a holy land because of its importance in the history of the battles with the Ottoman Empire. The closest comparison we as Americans might understand to these claims of ownership is to Jerusalem as a religious center of Christianity, or to Greece as the birthplace of Western culture. The status quo is maintained in Kosovo today by the presence of thousands of United Nations soldiers who act as peacekeepers. There is continued concern about vandalism of churches, mosques, and other holy places. Yet I frequently heard people in Kosovo say the conflict there has nothing to do with religion. What has emerged in a place like Kosovo is tension and conflict that surpasses negotiation. It is, in a way, irreducible. For Serbs and Albanians in Kosovo, even the sounds of each other's languages are fighting words to each respective people. Innocent bystanders on the streets have been killed for using the wrong language or for pronouncing the names of cities or places with the wrong pronunciation. For these people, language has become not a means of achieving understanding, but for playing out old hostilities and animosities. A key concept I've used to try to deal with these cultural problems is hidden transcripts. Few people can articulate their enmity. In turn, it is extremely difficult for outsiders to understand the hatred these groups have for each other, especially in the media's shorthand, which tries to simplify enormously complex problems. Finally, we will end our tour of international communication in Southeast Africa, in the former German colony that became Namibia. This is one of the areas of sub-Saharan Africa that has been afflicted by one of the worst AIDS epidemics in today's world. The scope of the problem is unprecedented. Worldwide, 25 million people have died from AIDS. We simply don't have anything to compare it to. In most of the nations of Southern Africa, about 20% of all adults are HIV positive. In some regional pockets, the rate of infection is as high as 50% of all adults, or even higher. But in general, it appears that there is somewhat of a leveling off in some parts of Southern Africa. The question I have asked, but have not been able to answer to my satisfaction, is why the AIDS epidemic is not on the front page of every major world newspaper and television broadcast every day. The absence of media coverage of this plague elsewhere in the world, in global news, is baffling given its importance, by virtually every rational standard of human life and suffering. Perhaps the lesson to be extracted from this experience is the cycle of news attention. Until there is some perceived change in the continuing bad news, the world will be satisfied to assume the worst. Perhaps the world is suffering again from a kind of compassion fatigue and is simply unable or unwilling to confront the immensity of this world disaster. In any case, the absence of attention to this important event constitutes a significant problem in international communication. But the problem with AIDS isn't just international. While teaching in Namibia, I examined the information campaigns that are being used to warn people about the threat of AIDS. There is abundant information about AIDS in most of Africa, especially in the urban areas. But the information campaigns have not yet had a significant effect on reducing the incidence of HIV infection. I don't have sufficient time here today to explore why AIDS information campaigns are often ineffective, but it is tied to the persistence of various cultural beliefs and practices among Africans. Some studies have shown that 2/3 of all Africans consult traditional healers several times a year. Some efforts are being made by African health programs to reach these traditional healers, but until most people realign their beliefs and behaviors, the disease will continue to spread. What is clear is that AIDS stigma, which is deeply rooted in various African cultures, is a reflection of these beliefs and behaviors. There are cultural reasons why AIDS persists in much of Africa, and medicine alone will not resolve the problem. Part of my work in Namibia was with the Panos Foundation of London, which is working to support local communication programs that help Africans to recognize the problem of AIDS at the lowest possible social and cultural levels, and then define the solution for people themselves. Finally, I want to describe here an interesting development recently in the field of global communication and emotions. A group of Dutch researchers recently announced they have developed a new computer program that can trace and explain significant changes in mood patterns on the internet. By sampling more than 2 million web logs, these researchers are able to track and chart the mood of the blogosphere. These researchers are trying to predict global mood swings among internet users. They post these emotional tracks on their webpage at www.moodviews.com, and it is updated every 10 minutes. Here's what the dominant moods they observed one recent afternoon. Which moods are hot, nostalgic, accomplished, sick, and calm? And which are not? Awake, hot, thirsty, bouncy. These researchers can also plot an emotion across time based on major events. For example, here is a chart showing how worried weblog users were before and after Hurricane Katrina in August 2005. While this kind of descriptive information tells us the obvious, perhaps, it also raises some interesting questions about why public levels of sympathy are higher for some disasters than others. While there are limitations to this kind of research tool, it does appear to be a new way to take the pulse of public emotions in the media. In conclusion, I'd like to suggest to you that while the world is shrinking, and there is much evidence of transparency in this shrinking world, there is good reason to be suspicious, or perhaps just to be cautious, in the global village. Both the speed and reach of communication technologies have created conditions that give shape to shared emotions. One of the dominant emotions is fear, but it isn't yet clear how global media might spawn other emotional states. I've also tried to show you how we negotiate some new kinds of international boundaries. In terms of communication, we find some messages are created because audiences demand them. Some misunderstandings run deep. And some important messages, like AIDS, are simply ignored. There is much yet that we do not understand about the new conditions of global communication. And we will yet see new emerging boundaries and divides and turbulence in this perplexing, shrinking world. Thank you.